Life is a journey. What's your story? Nanette Weiser here, and I am sitting with the president of the Warehouse Arts District. He is one of the most famous sculptors. You have seen the sundial, which has unfortunately gone away. The dolphins there, and I'm just so excited to have Mark Ayling here from MGA Sculpture Studio. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So you started out in St. Louis, 1996. 2005, you relocated MGA here to St. Pete, and it is the anchor studio within the Warehouse Arts District Association's Arts Exchange Campus. 5,000 square feet of studio space with 25-foot ceilings. Is that big enough to make sculptures?
Yeah, although, you know, I have to say we've been making some big pieces lately and had to do stuff in parts, but we still find a way to get it done.
Before we get into what you're doing here and now, tell us a little bit about your journey, because you've had many iterations as an artist and ended up with sculpture, but tell us a little bit about the family, your history of art in the family, and how you came to be here.
So without going back too far, I'll just start by saying that I was raised as an Army brat, and I've got three siblings, so there's four kids in our family, and we're all born in different cities in the United States. Actually, my sister was born in Landstuhl, Germany, when my father was stationed there. But he was a dermatologist in the Army, became chief of dermatology, and ended up in Denver, Colorado, which is where I primarily grew up. He did 20 years of service and finished, I think, just about his last 9 years, I think it was, all running the Department of Dermatology for the Army. So he was the chief and was stationed out of Fitzsimmons Army Medical. So I went to high school in Colorado, and I did my undergraduate studies there, and then went to Washington University in St. Louis. But my brother Jeff, who's 9 years older than me, he's a painter and went to the Kansas City Art Institute and has had quite an illustrious career selling paintings for, gosh, I think the last 40 years or so. So we were fortunate to have a show of his at Softwater, the gallery that my wife and I own, last year, maybe 2 years ago. Gosh, it's been a bit.
Didn't he do Florida Landscapes for that show?
Yes, he did.
So exciting to see his interpretation, because Whistler was an inspiration for him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had him down to document landscapes around here so he could do a suite of paintings that were specific to this area, and he did some really beautiful pieces for that show.
So your early work in sculpture was a bit inspired by doing theater and installations at the theater.
Yeah.
And opera.
You know, I cut my teeth doing scenic art. I worked for the Seattle Opera when I was... So to finish up my undergrad degree, I bounced all over the place. I got my diploma from Colorado State University while attending classes in University of Washington in Seattle. And it was surprisingly complicated, but I was transferring credits. And I spent about 3 years in Seattle. And while I was there, I worked for the Seattle Opera. And I learned more about the technical process of making, working for the opera, than I did in four years of undergraduate school. It was a huge eye opener to have that hands on experience, to learn how to read blueprints and how to use the scale rule and to generate elevations, front elevation, side elevation, plan view. That has really informed the way that I make sculpture, and it translates directly into how a computer thinks, that X, Y, and Z axis, which definitely influences the work that my studio is doing now.
You know, you say in a quote in a wonderful article that ran in the Creative Pinellas magazine that you learned how to manifest a concept in two dimensions that could be converted into a three-dimensional form. That's all theater, but that's all sculpture too.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's practical, tangible process of making. And sometimes, you know, art education gets esoteric and focuses on different kinds of things. Not that that isn't valuable. I learned an incredible amount in graduate school and in undergraduate school. You know, the core programs through undergrad, and I went to three different undergraduate schools. I was bouncing all over the place because I was still trying to figure out what it was about art and sculpture that I wanted to learn and what the place to, best place to do that was. So that process, it really codified through that experience of working for the opera. And then when I went to St. Louis for graduate school, I continued to do theater work and scenic work. You know, I was a professional scenic artist. I had union cards for United Scenic Artists and the IATSE, which is the Stagehands Union. If you're going to work in St. Louis professionally, even in creative fields, you got to be a union member. So
your first public, really your big breakthrough, 20 years doing art and different things, and then along comes Horseshoes. Tell us a little bit about your first public art commission in Austin, Texas, Ringers.
Boy, you did some research here. The Ringers piece is a piece that I did quite a while ago. I think that was around 2002, something like that. And at that point in time, I had formed a partnership with another artist, Kevin Garber, and he had a ceramic business, and we combined the sculpture studio and the ceramic studio, and we were doing a lot of work together and applying for public art applications, and we landed this project in Austin, Texas. And at that point in time, there was a bar that we shared a property line with, and they had a horseshoe pit, and we would go over there after work and drink beer and throw shoes. And it was a lot of fun, and it became the inspiration for this project because they had these two roundabouts that sat on either end of this development. And as soon as I saw the plan view of the project, I thought, man, that looks just like Horseshoe Pit. We could do a giant version of horseshoes. And that's how that piece came about. So 1 foot, 1 inch equaled 1 foot scale wise. So that made the horseshoes between 7 and 8 inch or 8 feet in diameter. And it was called Ringers because at one end, both the shoes are missing. On the other end, there's a shoe that's ringing the post. So
love that. So fast forward to St. Petersburg, your towering metal sculptures define St. Pete as much as our city murals. The recently demolished Sundial Shopping Center, we'll talk about that in a minute. The world's first commercial flight, where is that?
That's out on the pier, at the pier approach. Yeah, that's on the site of the original hangar for the first commercial aviation project that Tony Janus, of course, Janus Landing, he was the pilot, and Mayor Abe Vile was the first first paid passenger ever in the history of aviation. It's quite a feather in the cap of St. Pete, and I was very fortunate to be selected to make the project. My studio and I put that piece together, and it was a huge undertaking, and it's down on the pier.
And to those who have lost their lives in the days surrounding 9/11, where is that piece?
The Rise Monument is actually on the Arts Exchange campus, so it fronts 22nd Street.
And the role of law enforcement in our community.
So that's at the new police headquarters, which I think that's right around, that's First Avenue North and 13th, if I'm not mistaken. And we did the interior piece, which is called Shielded, which is a large aluminum wing that hangs from the ceiling, and it's an eagle wing. And then there's the outside piece, which is inspired by a gladiolus blossom.
You know, and that really speaks to the nature of the work. It's a really between style and structure, mundane and superficial, and you explore a lot of themes of community, culture, and the natural world. Tell us a little bit. You told me earlier, before we started our broadcast, about some pieces you're doing now with MGA Sculpture Studio, Mark.
Well, I should mention the piece that we just finished, which is a piece that went out to El Paso, Texas, and it was a 40-foot tall stainless steel wing. That piece is called Convocation, and a convocation is a large, important gathering. And the inspiration for that piece is an eagle wing. It's a vertically oriented wing of an eagle, and eagles are synonymous with law enforcement for Lots of symbolic reasons, honor and integrity and those kinds of things, which is very important to capture when you're talking about content. But what I wanted to do with that piece was connect the role of law enforcement to community. So I proposed this concept of utilizing all of the different birds in the region. So we did silhouettes of every bird that is in the El Paso region, everything from vultures to hummingbirds to hawks and pigeons and everything that you can imagine that flies through that area. And the reason for, and we did them all in as part of the skin, in actual scale. And the idea behind that is that skin is like a tapestry. It's this weaving of community, and all those different birds represent different aspects of community. And what the piece is trying to get at is what the function of law and law enforcement is in community. And in order for us as individuals to function in a social environment, we have to agree by a series of laws that allow us to interface. And that interface, it allows us to achieve more than we can as individuals. A group of people who work together can be very, very effective. And without that rule of law, that is not possible. And I think it's really easy to lose track when you start talking about law enforcement. It's a very polarizing topic these days, probably always. But without those laws, we really have to, I think it's important to look at what it is that makes society function and try and hold everyone to a higher standard.
So, you know, in the creation of public art, the viewer becomes part of the art. The reaction of the viewer becomes part of the art. I know that when I went to the 9/11 memorial, just the art becomes part of the environment, and it can change how you see and your perspective. So
absolutely,
you're always thinking about, it's not just the piece that is static, it is the people looking, observing, and it's a point of discussion and engagement.
Good public art is site specific, so it can help to transform the environment that it functions in. And when you start dealing with larger scale pieces that function in a setting, then they really begin to influence how you experience that space. And that's a really fun thing to play with as an artist.
I want to touch on something light and lively that you're doing here. Is there a strawberry in the works?
Yes, we are doing a large strawberry, and it's going over on the other side of the bay. And the community there, it's called Berry Grove, and I think it's, I may be pronouncing this wrong, but I think it's
Wamama?
Wamama, something like that.
Wamama?
It's about a 45-minute drive almost directly across from St. Petersburg if you take the Skyway. And we are about 50% through fabrication on that. And, in fact, we're prepping to pour the footer and base component this week. And it was showing at the studio during last art walk, and we'll be finishing it up. It should be outside of the studio for the next art walk, ready to be installed.
So I want to talk a little bit about the creative process. You have a team, a design team.
Yes.
You have fabricators and an office team. How does it go from start? Walk me through your creative process. Do you start with a sketch? Do you do CAD? I mean, tell us how that creative process works for you.
So the bulk of the work that we do at the studio is driven by public art, percent for art projects. So municipal entities around the country and some internationally put out calls. So what we apply for are RFQs, requests for qualifications. So at any given moment, we've got 60 to 80 calls out. And my office manager, Ashley Rivers, her primary responsibility is following all these different listing services and putting out these applications. So it gets real when we get shortlisted. So we'll get a call or an email, and it will say, hey, you've been selected as a finalist. And that usually means somewhere between 2 and 5 artists get selected out of anywhere from 50 to 250 that apply for these things. And once you get shortlisted, then we get a small stipend to create a concept. And that's when it gets serious. It gets real, where we're devoting a lot of time and resource to that portion of the process. It's rare that that stipend is financially significant enough to cover the cost of putting together what we call a pitch packet. In the good old days, that would include a three-dimensional model. These days, we do all of that in the computer, and my lead designer, Alex Kaufman, does an amazing job helping me realize my concept. So I usually generate the concepts every now and then. Like, my wife has done some great concepts for me. In fact, that strawberry piece, which... that we're working on right now, which has a really cool component, the seed structure and the way the skin is put together, it embodies the flower of life, which is kind of a nice tie into how plants grow and how plants reproduce and that kind of thing. But I digress. In relation to, you know, our creative process, I come up with a concept, and then Alex and I sit down and I share with him what I want to do. Sometimes there's a sketch. Sometimes it's just, you know, let's get on the internet and look at some source material. You know, it just really depends on what we're making, where the ideas are coming from. And then Alex will sit down and he'll make a stab at it in a really amazing 3D rendering program called Rhino. And it's a unique 3D rendering program in that it's very organic in the way that it works. And its full potential has yet to be completely realized, because there's so vast, the variability is so vast that Alex has been working with it for over 10 years, and we're still discovering new ways of manifesting three-dimensional form. And every now and then I'll sit down with Alex and we'll be looking at something, and I'll say, can you do this? And I'm wondering if it's possible to twist this way, or can we bend this, or, you know, that kind of thing. And Alex will, you know, dig through all of the different ways of doing things, and he'll come upon a way of rendering something that we haven't done before. So we're constantly pushing the parameters of that program and of his capacity, of my capacity. And as long as we're doing that, then we're all having fun, and it feels like the studio is growing and the work is staying relevant.
And speaking of creative process, you and your wife are both artists. Carrie Jadis. Did I say her last name right?
Carrie Jadis, yes.
Jadis. And tell us a little bit about Carrie's work.
Before we jump to Carrie's work, let me say one more thing about the process, because I stopped at the design component.
Yes.
Once we get through that, and I have to give a nod to my fabrication team, George Redkes is my studio manager, and he handles all the labor, and we work together to come up with processes for how we're going to manifest stuff. We design everything through a conceptual component. We sell the project, we get it under contract, and then we go into technical design and engineering, and then we have to figure out how we're actually going to make it, how we're going to use the materials, and how it comes together. And George and Alex and I work together to solve those problems. And then the material hits the floor. We do all of our cutting and probably 95% of our material processing in-house. So we're making everything in-house, and then we're doing all of our installation and the rigging and all of that kind of stuff. And that's, to me, where it gets really, really fun. The rigging stuff is a blast.
Do you go to the city and install it yourself?
Yes. We almost always do, because nobody knows the pieces better than we do. And when we have really irregularly formed heavy objects, things that can weigh thousands and thousands of pounds, the center of gravity is peculiar, and we pick them up and move them around, and we learn them and we design them to be moved in very specific ways. So it's best if we do our own installation. The transportation is pretty much the only thing we occasionally outsource.
You know, I could see you playing with Legos as a kid.
I was a big Lego kid, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
So when the time we have left, just tell us a little bit about your wife and her work, and you wanted to also talk about another artist you had mentioned?
My wife is an amazing painter, Carrie Jadis. She has her own business, Carrie Jadis Fine Art, and she and I, when we met, we started Softwater at that time Softwater Studios, and we kept a portion of the studio space that we leased to other artists. We kept that as a gallery space, and we thought it would be beneficial for ourselves and our other artist friends, and to help build a community to have a gallery space. And when the Arts Exchange was first started, it was one of the more refined spaces on the campus, because the campus was pretty rough. Now we've gone through and refurbished almost all of the campus. The Warehouse Arts District Association has, and Softwater was looking rough around the edges. So a year and a half ago, we got serious about turning Softwater into a full-blown gallery. And it was seasonal before that because it didn't have climate control. And now it's got full climate control, and we've finished up all the surfaces. And we've got a gallery director who's absolutely outstanding, Lisa Lippincott, and she does incredible curation. And she's got some beautiful work in there right now. And we're still in the process of growing the gallery. This last year was our first year. This is our second year. We're halfway through it, and it's been a very good year so far.
That is wonderful. I want to say, Mark, we have the Warehouse Arts District is growing, and we love the amphitheater there. We're delighted to have the St. Pete Jazz Festival. Give us in a nutshell, I know that there's a lot of challenges right now, and we'll have you back to talk about that. As president of the Warehouse Arts District, what message do you want to give to the community?
Well, I have to give a shout out to Marcus Gottslich, who is our executive director. He's, I believe, his second year point, and he's done a great job of solidifying the campus and expanding the events and things that we're doing. And we've got the Arts Exchange campus pretty much buttoned up, and our focus right now is shifting more outward. We have a piece of property that we have obtained that is just to the west of our main campus, and we are seriously investigating live work for artists, subsidized living and working spaces as an addition to the studios that we have on the main portion of the campus, because there is a huge urgent need in this community because of the cost of living to subsidize spaces specifically for artists, so we can keep the amazing creative community that we have here. And so St. Louis doesn't lose its buzz and the great energy that it's got.
Well, you know what? Not only are you creating large, monumental, and memorable sculptures, you're creating a safe space for artists here in town. You're creating art in public places, which makes our town such a wonderful tourism destination. Mark, thank you so much for being here. MGA Sculpture Studio and the Warehouse Arts District on the Arts Exchange campus. Don't forget to go to Art Walk. Check their website. And parting words, Mark.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to share what we've been up to, and we've got an important event coming up it's actually at Softwater at the Arts Exchange, where we're going to be talking about what's going on with the recent line item veto by the governor of all arts funding by the state, which is a pretty big deal.
And we encourage you all to come to the Palladium to hear this conversation as well. So thank you, Mark. MGA Sculpture Studio, Softwater Galleries, and we look forward to having you back. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.